The identification is redundant. Never in the history of the spoken word has a voice been so instantly recognizable. Orson Welles was one of the most flamboyant personalities ever to come before the public. Physically enormous, 6'4", intellectually brilliant, and possessed of an incomparable voice. As flexible as it was deep, as expressive as it was dramatic. He made a difference to everything he touched.
In just a moment, you will hear The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
As actor, director, writer, producer, he introduced daring innovations in each of the many media in which he was engaged: radio, theater, film, even ballet. But for all his originality, one thing for him mattered above all others: storytelling.
Here in the grim stone structure on the Thames which houses Scotland Yard is a warehouse of homicide, where everyday objects, a paperweight, a woolen muffler, an old-fashioned hatpin, a drinking glass, all are touched by murder. Here's a bit of frosted glass. It's a familiar object. You've seen such glass before in the upper panels of the doors of older houses, and perhaps the one in which you live. Let's in more light, the owner used to say. One man climbing to his old-fashioned apartment said to his son,
"Hello, what's this? Glass on the landing?"
"From the door, Dad. It looks like the frosted panel fell out."
"Yes, and pretty jaggedly. Be careful, son. Those shards are sharp."
Well, today the glass shards can be seen in the Black Museum.
He had a special knack of engaging the attention of his listeners, of confiding in them, but also of sharing a point of view with them. You always felt that he was speaking to you and to you alone, and that you and he understood things in a way that others perhaps did not. It was flattering, stimulating, and utterly compelling. Once he started on one of his stories, it was hard to stop listening. This extraordinary gift stood him in very good stead in bar rooms and restaurants, in rehearsal rooms and on film sets. But above all, it made him perhaps the greatest performer who has ever appeared on radio.
Nice, here we are, the glass shards. They're sharp, pointed. Dangerous to life and limb, even in themselves. Here they are, glistening, gleaming in their whitely frosted danger. Once they were part of a whole. The glass panel, as I told you, of an apartment door. But we'll come to that. Let's begin this tale with the ringing of a doorbell.
He was born in Kenosha, Wisconsin, near Chicago, in 1915, to a father who was an independently wealthy playboy and a very serious mother who had been a suffragette, a concert pianist, and a pioneer of education. She it was who introduced her precocious son to Shakespeare and world literature. She it was who instilled in him the idea that he must justify himself by never being less than brilliant. She died when he was 9. Shortly after, he was sent away by his father to the Todd School for Boys, one of the most enlightened educational establishments in America, equipped with every facility: farming utensils, an aerodrome, workshops, aviaries, and most important for the young Welles, a theatre and a studio with radio and recording facilities. Orson promptly colonized all of them, and became at the age of 12 or 13 a master of these media, designing, adapting, directing and starring in plays, some of which he subsequently recorded or broadcast. After leaving school, at the age of 16, he went on a tour of Ireland, and improbably found himself playing leading parts at the famous Gate Theatre in Dublin. Years later, in a documentary celebrating his friends Michael McLearmore and Hilton Edwards, who ran the Gate Theatre, he recalled that stormy start.
"Well, by Act Four, on that first night, I'd aged somewhat. This was partly because I was supposed to do so in the play, but I had grown older under the grease paint as well. By Act Four, a terrible truth had dawned on me, that an audience is not so much a compliment to an actor's ego as a challenge to his capacities. In Act Four, I received my first challenge. I was not only innocent of any experience in the theater, but of any experience with an Irish audience. I had no inkling of the Dubliner's almost professional pride in unpredictability. Act four, as I say, and a very pretty girl, Betty Chancellor, had just left the stage. I was supposed to leer after a departing figure, chortle lecherously, and speak the following line. I can still remember it exactly. Indeed, I don't think I'll ever be able to forget it. A bride fit for Solomon, I was to say. But it was the next phrase which for some reason gave offense. Solomon had 1,000 wives, did he not? Now, at this moment, an indignant male voice rose loudly from somewhere in the audience. That, said the voice, is a dirty black Protestant lie. With that cry from the darkness, it was borne in upon me with frightful force that as an actor, I wasn't so much skating on thin ice as being on thin air. Realizing this, Pluto the pup, I started falling. It was actually a fall that saved me in Act Five. In the play, I was supposed to die of ecstasy, and in fact, I was half dead from fright. Prior to the final curtain, I had been instructed by Hilton to draw my sword, brand it, shout, rails, and fire the cannon, and slump lifelessly back onto my walk. So to feel just putting the breath.